You're listening to the MoneyWeb Now podcast series with Simon Brown. Live streamed every weekday at 6:30 a.m.
It's Friday, 11 June. I'm Simon Brown, coming at you live and loud from the MoneyWeb Global Headquarters in Johannesburg, South Africa. On the show today, we're chatting with Nessa Naya from Sasfin, multi-choice results. We're talking with Vikas Frustenberg from Future Growth. U.S. inflation, 5%, the highest in a decade. Core inflation, 4%, the highest in three decades. And then Adam Gottlich from Standard Bank on behavioral finance, behavioral science, how we can be smarter. Some morning headlines from CNBC. Inflation is hotter than expected, but looks temporary and likely won't affect Fed policy yet. Business Day, business confidence returns to pre-COVID-19 levels, rebounded especially in manufacturing, which I suppose is probably feeding into the mining space, retail trade and motor trade. There's motor trade. We saw the motors update. Man, that motor trade is just weird, to be honest. Morning markets, US was green, S&P up 0.5%, NASDAQ up 0.8%. Asia, mixed. We've got Sydney up 0.3% and Tokyo off 0.1%. Commodities mixed overnight, gold edging higher at 1903, Rand 1358. And top 40, we're looking for a green open, 120 points. What's that? 0.2%.
MoneyWeb Now, on the money. Also available on podcast.
Trading now with Nessa Naya, portfolio manager at Sasfin. Nessa, appreciate the early morning results coming through. Two that struck me. One was multi-choice, and a lot of moving parts there. I mean, South Africa kind of looks ex-growth. They're doing all right in the rest of the continent. And then, of course, increasing their stake in BetKing, which is an attempt to, I suppose, diversify their income stream. Your take on the results, your take on multi-choice as an investment opportunity?
Yeah, good morning, Simon. You know, I actually thought it was a good set of results, given all the various factors playing into it. As you said, many, many moving parts. You know, revenue was up a bit. Profits were up a lot.
Yeah.
So as a result, you know, they did a very good job of managing costs. And I think that has a lot to do with management on the one hand. I think they were focused on trying to cut costs. They did mention that, you know, that was a key area in which they needed to attend to, given what was happening last year. And, you know, I'm not sure, you know, to what extent the exchange rate played a big role in that, because remember, a lot of the content they buy is in US dollars. We've seen the exchange rate strengthen. So, and I think it's important for investors to understand that, because, you know, exchange rate benefits don't come through every year. In the past, multi-choice has really struggled, you know, with trying to contain that exchange rate. But, you know, revenues obviously in the rest of Africa improving. It's an important, you know, overall indicator of how well they're doing in the rest of the continent. So for me, as you say, many, many moving parts. As an investment, you know, it's hard to say right now. It's, you know, sports still remains a key contributor, I think, to their overall revenue streams. Although, I mean, they did say most of the revenue, I think, out of the $50 billion, $44 billion comes from subscriptions and only 10% from advertising. So, you know, one has to understand to what extent they can grow the advertising part of that business. But, you know, for me, it's all about video on demand in that space, in the entertainment space. You know, it's about Netflix, it's about Walt Disney. So I'm not keen on the investment case for multi-choice, although you may get good dividends out of it. It's not something I can
That's a fair point. Or I mean, basically, dividend was HEPS, but I take your point. Their competitors are global, and their competitors have deep pockets. We also saw Fashini Group out with numbers coming through for year end March. Again, moving parts, write downs, all sorts of things. But short answer, a tough set of numbers for them. Although the market was perhaps a little bit forgiving, I suppose we can say, you know, it was pandemic, it was write downs. That's behind you now.
Yeah, so I think, you know, these results are obviously 12-month results, so it takes into consideration, you know, the whole period of sort of 2020, March 2020 to March 2021. And I think, you know, the recent one needs to be careful not to compare them against the recent trading update that we've had that only take into consideration 3 months or six months performance. Of course, the first 6 months of last year, very difficult for clothing retailers across the board, largely because the whole country was shut down, you know. I didn't see, and what disappointed me is, you know, to the extent that the likes of Mr. Price have been made that big investment in online, I didn't get the impression, you know, that Fushini was doing too much along those lines. You know, they do have an online offering, of course, but it seems to me the focus hasn't really been, you know, to try and grow that aspect of the business. Again, as you say, too many moving parts. A bit of a drag, I think, you know, the fact that the numbers were actually showing that they were trending downwards. But, you know, I think it's going to take some time for these clothing retailers to really bounce back. If the current environment sustains and interest rates stay low, I think they might actually recover faster than what we all think. But, you know, my own view is that, you know, retail seems to be more and more dominated now by online, and I like to see the South African retailers, you know, making a bigger investment in that specific area of sales.
Yeah, otherwise they get lost, left behind. I mean, it's superb list, as you say. Mr. Price is doing a fairly good job there. First move is important. Doing it well is important as well. But I take your point. I don't see it much happening out of Fushini yet. Nasen Naya, portfolio manager, Sasfin Securities. Appreciate the early morning, sir.
Business, finance, and investment news. MoneyWeb now
with Simon Brown
on the money. Also available on podcast.
Chatting now with Vikas Vestenberg. He's head interest rate a process at Future Growth. Vikas, appreciate the early morning time. We chatted what must have been about a month and a day ago, just ahead of what was then April inflation data. We saw May yesterday. Numbers coming in giant. But when we were speaking back then, you were saying, you know, yeah, inflation's going to be big, but it really is that transitory. It really is that base effect. Is that still the key sort of point that you're taking on US inflation and to a degree our own local?
Good morning, Simon. Yes, most certainly. I think the, you know, second quarter this year is still going to be quite, you know, distorted on the back of those base effects and significant change. I think a little bit more complicated perhaps in US with, you know, used car sales and things like that, because, I mean, we know about supply issues, which obviously would affect, I would think, new vehicle sales, and that then spills over into the used vehicle sales. So, you know, so we never be, you know, always sort of fear inflation, because in my world, I mean, we got two arch enemies. I mean, one is obviously default, and the other one is inflation. So, so we do keep a beady eye on that, but for now, if you look at sort of the velocity of money, and if you look at things like inflation expectations, those structural things are still sort of like suggest that this is transitionary. So, but of course, we always have to be careful not to overestimate. But so far, what's happening is not just inflation data. I mean, as you know, I mean, we saw distortions in with other macroeconomic data releases as well, including, you know, labor market reports. So this is going to be a messy, very messy second quarter. But we still have the view that inflation in particular will sort of like decelerate to lower levels in the second half of this year. For those reasons mentioned.
Will we see, I mean, to your point, I mean, you know, a pandemic, the first in 100 years, the data that sort of follows it is going to be as messy as heck. When do we sort of expect it to start to sort of revert back to normal? Is it later this year, or is it still challenges around supply chains and the like, and we're still in a scenario where actually the sort of weird data could continue into next year?
You're probably going to sort of see periods where you know you're still going to see sort of like these distortions coming through, but I think the big one in terms of the base effect is going to be second quarter in terms of upward pressure. But I think we also need to start thinking about, you know, the second quarter of last year. The second quarter of next year, where this year's higher base will of course now, you know, contribute to perhaps lower numbers. in the second quarter of next year, which should also be treated with caution by central banks, and which I'm pretty sure they will, because they do realize, they need to be careful how they respond to volatility and data and not overreact, i.e. Hike rates now and then cut rates next year. Mm-hmm. You can't do that. And I think they're very clear in their messaging, both in South Africa and in most global markets as well.
Yeah, I hadn't even thought about that. But of course, next year, I'm going to put a note to my calendar to say, don't panic, because it's now, or don't get excited. It's going to be that base effect. I mean, you mentioned central banks. And I mean, the world over, they do, and they're central bankers. So their job is to, stare off into the distance and not blink. But they seem to be sticking to it. There does seem to be a strong will, a strong intent. The Fed is saying, it's unemployment that we're going to focus on. And they're sticking to their guns on that for now.
Absolutely. I mean, they don't just sort of target inflation. They have to sort of like be sensitive to economic growth as well. And the central bank locally is doing the same thing. So that, I think it's also now that, I mean, when we had that discussion last time, we also talked about the U.S. Treasury market. Mm-hmm. Things. It's sort of like just got carried away. And forward rate markets and all that, and sort of like, including the local forward rate agreement market, and things have calmed down. I mean, yesterday, for instance, the U.S. 10-year yield is actually slightly lower post the upside surprise in that CPI data. So I think the message has reached the market for now. But that said, Simon, I think, for the second half of this year, we need to sort of like think about, the Fed start talking about tapering. At some point that's going to come. So maybe that's also where I want to sort of shift my focus now to say, listen, you have to expect them to start doing something about that at some point and start talking about that. But I think what they want is to sort of make sure that it's well telegraphed and that we don't see this sort of panicky response by financial markets, like we've witnessed the first quarter of this year.
Yeah, and that's a great point. It's the tapering. There's two parts to it. One is the interest rates, as you say. U.S. 10-year back at 1.5%. Locally, our 10-year is under 9%. The next big story is going to be that tapering component. But certainly, at this point, the market is believing and trusting in the Fed. The communication around the tapering is going to be the next, the sort of almost, it's going to be before the rate increases.
Oh yeah, for sure. No, that, exactly. They don't want to sort of, they don't want to repeat the mistake they made in 2013, and it was not intentional. It was just like maybe naive. Say, listen, we are messaging you, we're telling you that we're going to hike rates, and oh my goodness, there we go. So you don't want that sort of volatility. The same locally. We know that the central bank, the market sort of, just made too much of that quarterly model of the central bank, which only merely serves as one of many inputs. And they made it clear that, we can't just hang our hat onto one little model. So guys, sort of like just focus on the big picture here. So, but even in that case, I think, at some point we need to start thinking about that. But I think there's less pressure on the South African Central Bank to start talking about that than, for instance, in the case of the Federal Reserve, because, in SA, it's not like rates are at those very low levels. Yes, it's low, it's the lowest in decades, sure, but it's not as extreme as the case in the United States, for instance.
We'll leave that there, Vikas Vuchtenberg, Head Interest Rate Process Future Growth. Appreciate the early morning, sir.
Investors now have a final opportunity to invest in a Section 12J investment by the 30th of June. To learn more, join MoneyWeb's editor Rake van Niekerk with Jaltek's Gaurav Nair and Jonty Sachs as they unpack and highlight their top-performing Section 12J investments in a free webinar on Tuesday, 15 June at 12 p.m. Register for the webinar on moneyweb.co.za. MoneyWeb, business and investment insights.
MoneyWeb now on the money.
Chatting now with Adam Gottlich. He is Head Behavioral Science for Client Solutions at Standard Bank. Adam, appreciate the early morning time. Behavioral science, I want to delve into first sort of, I suppose, what it is and how it can play a role in consumer choices. I mean, in essence, we're human beings. We make lots of bad decisions, and behavioral science is trying to, almost in a way, nudge, and of course there's a book around that, us to do better financial decisions.
Good morning, Simon. Yes, absolutely. So behavioral science, what it is, it's a multidisciplinary approach to understanding human decision making. Mm-hmm. It draws on insights from neuroscience, cognitive science, psychology, economics, anthropology, to really understand why we behave the way we do and mm-hmm. why we make the choices we make. It's a very scientific pursuit. It draws on a lot of excellent academic research and the applied scientific method to really help discern how to help people make better decisions. But in order to help them make better decisions, you often have to understand the psychology of what stands in the way of those decisions. And those are often referred to as cognitive biases or cognitive bottlenecks.
Yeah, and I mean, those exist. And I mean, they exist in every field. There's probably a heck lot more. I was chatting with someone yesterday, you know, one of the biggest challenges to the investment community, the threats, the competition, for example, is actually scams, because we want to get rich in a hurry. We believe that. And in essence, if we can understand people's processes, their fears, their greeds, their emotions around it, we can kind of guide them and help them to markedly better financial decisions. And the implications then are if we make better financial decisions, we are ultimately better off financially. In other words, we'll have more money, we'll retire better.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think understanding those bottlenecks are very important in terms of designing solutions that can overcome them. So you can't paint everybody with the same brush, and every choice environment is different in terms of, you know, what stands in the way of making better decisions. But there's certainly some human universals that we know to be true that really undermine our own, you know, our future utility and our good decision making strategies. As an example, we typically don't deal well when a lot of choice is presented to us. So when there are a lot of options presented to us, we typically respond with no decision. But in the first place, we actually seek out that amount of choice. So we like choice, but hate to choose. We don't save for the future because we are incredibly present biased. Mm-hmm. And that's the manifestation of a decision-making strategy that's thousands and thousands of years old, that's been misapplied into today's sort of complex financial climate. We don't consider all our options. We often choose the default option just because it's the easiest option, not necessarily because it's the best option. And sometimes, and what we've seen a lot in COVID over the past year or so, is people take action not because it's the right thing to do, but to regain a sense of control. And as a result, potentially undermine their own sort of future utility by making a poor decision in the moment. So by using behavioral science, you can absolutely help somebody make a better decision by understand what's sort of undermining them in the immediate term.
And as financial institutions, Standard Bank and others the world over, taking this into account is you can actually make better products designed for this. I'm thinking the option one, and I know an experiment that was done at one of the universities in the US where, in terms of their retirement annuity, the 401k, the default was already ticked and you only had two options, yay or nay. And that was trying to sort of guide and steer people to a decision, which truthfully, we're being a bit nanny here, but it's for their own benefit.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's a concept within behavioral science. It's called asymmetric paternalism. And basically, it's providing an option of what we think is the best option and nudging people to choose mm-hmm. that option without restricting any of their freedoms. So people can absolutely make whatever decision they want, but we help and try and nudge them towards a better decision. And the study that you're referring to absolutely generated a huge amount of value for people. It's the Save More Tomorrow program, and it's generated billions of dollars worth of savings for over 15 million Americans. And it's because they understood three key bottlenecks. They understood that you needed to really make a commitment to long-term saving mm-hmm. by overcoming present bias. They wanted to create a default option that was easy for you, so there was no friction. And they wanted to reduce loss aversion by making sure that your contributions were tied to salary increases. So there was never sort of any situation where you were out of pocket. So I think financial institutions, are seriously investing in behavioral science because it's the ultimate form of customer centricity by considering the human on the end of the experience. And you're seeing it manifest in a number of ways, from the way that we design products to, you know, an increased focus on financial literacy, to making sure that we are more deliberate about the way we communicate with customers, just to make sure that we are being human first and human focused. And especially now as we're becoming more and more digital, I think behavioral science is the way to deliver human experiences digitally.
And at the point, without restricting freedoms, this isn't to restrict someone what they're doing, it's just to, it's nudging, it's helping them. Adam Gottlich, Head Behavioral Science, Client Solutions, Standard Bank, appreciate the early morning. That's it for today. Our poll we asked you yesterday, strong update from Motus, that stock almost 4x in the last year. The question we asked is, did you get some of that 4x? 75% of you missed it. That was me. 15% got it. 10% went and bought a car and were helping with that part. Remember, next week I am on leave. I am not here. We're getting a whole bunch of folks to come and do individual takeovers. Gary Boyson, Kia Nunyama, Keith McLachlan, Chantal Marks. We each get a day in the hot seat next week. I'll be back Monday after that. We're live every weekday morning, 6:30 a.m. MoneyWeb website and the app. Podcast from 7. Huge thanks to my team, Eddie, Cordora, Nicole, to you for listening, my guests for their early morning contributions. My name is Simon Brown. This is MoneyWeb Now, and we'll chat week after next.
You've been listening to another MoneyWeb Now podcast, posted every weekday at 7 a.m. on moneyweb.co.za. MoneyWeb Now, on the money.